that COP26 and just large environmental and climate conferences are such a scam. Basically, PR events, my friend Aisha actually, she called it the Coachella of the climate crisis.
Hello.
And welcome to the We Do Hope podcast from Amos Trust.
I'm Jessie.
And I'm Tilly, and we'll be your hosts, as each episode we'll be joined by fascinating guests from around the world, exploring what hope means to them.
We'll be jumping in at the deep end, talking to people about some of their biggest challenges and where they find hope in their daily lives.
These conversations might inspire, surprise, or move you, but we'll come away with a little bit more hope. Hopefully.
So, let's dive in.
Hi, Jessie.
Hello, Tilly.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. It's lovely to speak to you. How are you doing?
I'm really good, thank you.
Good. I'm very excited for today as well and our guest. She sounds absolutely incredible. Why don't you introduce her?
So our guest today is a young climate activist called Disha Ravi, who, like the network of activists around the world, represents hope in the midst of a crisis that is the biggest humanity faces. The climate emergency is something I know many people can feel overwhelmed by at times. I know I have. Disha campaigns on an issue that affects every single one of us, and yet, as it currently stands, not equally.
Yeah, it got me thinking about that classic phrase of being in the same storm, but not all in the same boat. Mm. And I know one of the main strands of Amos Trust's work is supporting projects in the global south, in countries including India, which is where our guest is from, which are suffering the effects of climate breakdown most aggressively. Growing up in central India, Disha has experienced this firsthand, and I'm really interested to know how this experience has shaped her into the person and the climate activist she is today.
Do you remember a few years ago when Greta Thunberg started striking from school on a Friday in Sweden, and there was this massive global movement called Fridays for Future? So at the time, Disha was at college in Bengaluru, India, and she responded by coordinating strikes every week and co-founding Fridays for Future India. And so she became really well known on the environmental scene, described as turning up every local protest, every rally, and speaking with a real depth of knowledge about what's at stake. And as such, she's been featured in Vogue, New York Times, The Guardian, publications all around the world. She's in a TEDx talk, which I'd really recommend. And the New India Express called her Bengaluru's Greta Thunberg, which is a comparison we're going to talk to her about. In 2021, she planned to travel to Glasgow's COP26 climate summit to join other activists from around the world, reporting for the news organization GRIST. But she was denied a passport. At the time, she tweeted, "I deserved to be there." And later, we're going to talk to her about intersectionality in the climate justice movement.
And Disha's story is also a reminder that not only are we not all affected by the current impact of the climate crisis to the same degree, we are not also free to speak out and call for change without risking our own personal freedoms. So in 2021, Disha, the face of Bengaluru's student protest scene, would become the face of India's crackdown on dissent when she was arrested, aged just 21, and charged with criminal conspiracy. Her crime? Circulating an online toolkit. Now, we won't be talking about this arrest in any more detail today for legal reasons, but it's a reminder of the harsh realities that activists face just for standing against the status quo. We are so interested to talk to Disha today about maintaining hope when the world is literally on fire and when the powers that be seem intent on not listening. We'll talk to her about the need for community and activism and on the importance of intersectionality and tackling racism in environmentalism. And we'll also talk to her about how she stays hopeful day to day, the little things she does to look after herself and keep going. She is also a big animal lover by the looks of things. And I do really want to find out who that ridiculously cute dog is on her Insta.
Yeah, let's get our priorities straight. So without further ado, we are so honoured to welcome our guest for today, Disha Ravi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We are so excited to have you today.
It's so cool to speak to you.
Sorry, I'm so excited to talk to you guys too.
So where are you speaking to us from today, Disha? Can you explain where you are and what you can see?
I'm in my room in Bangalore, and I'm actually in the terrace right now, so I can see the flowers that my mother has planted, and it's like you know, waving because there was a like wind coming through, and it's like the perfect summer day as I described it earlier. before we started this podcast. But it's the perfect weather. I'm so happy summer is here.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. I'm very jealous of that sunshine and heat. So one of the things we always start with on this podcast is we start with the same question each time. And I mean, you've just described, I already feel better kind of hearing your situation and the plants and the sunshine has made me feel better. But is there something that has made you feel particularly hopeful this week? As you know, this podcast is all about hope. And yeah, we'd love to know if there's something small this week or something big that's kind of really cheered you up and made you feel hopeful before we get into the actual podcast.
I think this is both small and big at the same time, because on Sunday, I met up with the larger environmental movement in Bangalore that includes not just Fridays for Future, but other environmental movements here. And it was really nice to meet them because it's been a while since I met them in person because of COVID and the pandemic and the lockdown. But I was able to finally meet them in person after almost a year. And we were working on the global climate strike that's happening next week on Friday. So it was really exciting because to me, the strikes are both a celebration and a protest, because it's a celebration of community and hope and people power, but it's also a protest about, you know, demanding the government to do better.
Yeah, that's the March 25th global climate strike that you just mentioned, isn't it, Disha?
Yeah.
So if you listen to this podcast, it's probably going to come out after the 25th of March. But I'm hoping you were there. We're going to be there, aren't we, Jessie?
Mm-hmm, striking. Absolutely.
So, yes.
I think it would be good if you could take us back to the beginning, if you don't mind. So thinking back to if you could tell us about where you grew up and your experiences, with the climate crisis and how you kind of became interested in that. Just take us back to the beginning and describe that kind of journey for you.
So I was born in Tiptur, which is a town 3 hours away from Bangalore. And that's my grandparents' house. And they live in a little village near Tiptur. I was born there. But my parents moved around a lot because my dad's work depended on it. But I think I was 3 years old when we moved to Bangalore, and I started schooling here, and I've spent most of my life in Bangalore, except for 2 years where I spent it in Mangalore, which is another city with the same spelling except for the B and it's replaced by M, which is...
That's helpful.
Yeah. Easy to remember.
Yeah, it's in the coastal part of Karnataka, same state. And I really like living there. I did my 11th and 12th grade there because my dad had to move again. And I really enjoyed living in a coastal city because it was beautiful. I loved the ocean so much. It's a sign of all peace and hope for me. And I love living close to it. And I hate living in Bangalore. I love living in Bangalore, but it's still a landlocked city and it's so sad.
I can totally relate to that, living in London. I'm always really jealous of people that are by the sea. There's something so soothing for the soul, I think, about being near the water.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the ocean is just so marvelous, and I wish I could spend more time near it. But, it wasn't actually until much later in my life, when I was around 18, that I realized anything about the climate crisis, because I did spend a lot of time at my grandparents' house growing up, and they had to face the water crisis when I was quite young because the underground water is heavily exploited in India, but almost 80% of the entire country is dependent on underground water for agriculture, irrigation, or just drinking water reasons. And because of that, they didn't have access to the underground water anymore. And they weren't aware of like rainwater harvesting. I don't even know if it was a thing back 20 years ago in India, at least. So they had to suffer quite a bit to grow their, produce, and they didn't realize why it was happening. And I also didn't realize it. And they had one shared community well that all the other villagers would come to and, fetch water from. And then, you know, divert the water from that. But that was so erratic because they never had electricity except for like 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. That's it. And throughout the day, we are. So they had to fill the water in during those times. And even today, it's the case. I think from like last month, they've been getting more electricity. But yeah. So because of that, they had to suffer through a lot of it. And I didn't think much of it back then. And I thought this is how everyone lives. And even when we moved back to Bangalore, when we moved to Bangalore when I was three, my mom still had to like always fetch water from, you know, the local water source. And that's what everyone did. So I thought it was completely normal until much later on. And I moved away. Further away from the city in Bangalore. And I realized that the further you move away, the less exploited the underground water levels are. And we didn't have to, you know, suffer as much for water. Sure, it's still there, but that's when I realized that's not the norm, suffering for...
So how old were you when you realized that, Disha?
I think it was quite late. I think I was like 18 because that's when I moved back to Bangalore. Because in 11th and 12th I was in Mangalore, and I was quite surprised. And it was only then that I had access to the internet for the whole like day. Before it was just like once a month or something. Because I lived in Mangalore, I lived in the middle of a forest. We hardly got reception. So it was only then that I started reading about it. And I realized that this is not the norm, and it's actually, you know, interlinked with the climate crisis.
So you were kind of experiencing the impacts of the climate crisis without necessarily knowing that that was what that was and what was happening.
Yeah, because we never learned about the climate crisis in school. Even today, you know, education that's anything related to the climate crisis is limited to very private elite schools that not everyone has access to, that only the, you know, the very rich and the very privileged have access to. And nature-based learning is very important, but it's really... it's not in public schools. It's not made easily available to the public. So it's very concerning because environmentalism in India is often seen as an issue of the urban elite or indigenous/Adivasi people in India, which creates a very polarizing narrative of the issue when it really does impact all of us.
So would you wish to see environmentalism being taught in schools from, you know, preschool age and upwards, like, because I think that's the experience that, you know, we were fortunate enough to have. Jesse and I were being taught about turning your taps off and, you know, all of that kind of small child environmentalism lessons. We were kind of being fed that from such an early age. But is that what you'd like to see, as well as other things?
I would like to see that. I think more than that, I would like to see environmentalism presented as more than just trees, because we also did have some stories about Vandana Shiva and, you know, the farm she runs and seed conservation. We also had some stories about other environmental movements like the Chipko movement. But it was never in detail, and it was seen as like one chapter in literature or something. It was never a separate topic. Environmental studies, although it was there for like a few years, we were never graded on it, so no one really bothered to read anything about it. It was seen as a subject that everyone could be dismissive about. So, and even that was not adequate education, because it didn't really teach us about the climate, could hardly talked about the climate. It was very limiting in various ways, and it was almost greenwashed to a certain extent. So I think that is something we need to change, because I see the curriculums of like private schools that most people can't afford, and it's amazing. It's great environmental education, and I strongly believe that all education straight up should be free, because it's education. Why are we pricing it? So that's something I hope to work on one day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so important that everyone is educated on this topic, because it affects absolutely everybody. And I know, I think from my experience, like kind of education on environmentalism was actually quite patchy. There was like the smaller things you could do, but I don't think I realized the seriousness of what's happening until I was quite old, actually. So I think the language has changed recently around it. And I think people are talking about it so much more.
Just on language, actually, Jessie, I wondered, Disha, if you could explain the term mapper and what that means, because I think one of the things we find so interesting reading about you and your work was how the sort of the language, the term Global South, and how that wasn't quite right. And so you and your colleagues decided to change that. So can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So when we were working in Fridays for Future International, what we realized was that the larger climate movement and the narratives that are very popular in public are always set by people in the global north, very white people in the global north. And it always feels like they're speaking on behalf of people in the global south. And even in the global south, there are some more marginalized than the others. Like in India, we have Adivasis, Dalits, Muslims, who have to face repercussions worse than other people. So I think the language was really lost on this, and I actually wrote about this, about how we need to change the climate conversations to really, you know, enable climate action. So that's, MAPA was the start of that. We were really tired of being referred to as the Global South, because it felt like, and not just that it feel, but also if you look at the way the term came to be about, it was formed on economic basis. It was formed to showcase that, you know, we are, quote unquote, a third world country, and we're not economically strong. But while in reality, a lot of the Global North countries steal and exploit from our people and steal our resources to benefit themselves and send their pollution to us. So we wanted to change that. We wanted to change that the narrative is not about, you know, the global north's future, because it's often about the future. It's often about the white child's future. And we wanted to bring back the narrative that it's not just about the white child's future. It's about brown children, black people, and like indigenous people's present, that we are facing the impacts of the climate crisis. And climate justice isn't just for the white and the rich, it's for, you know, everybody, but especially people who are most impacted. So MAPA stands for most impacted people and areas. And now the definition has broadened to also include BIPOC from Global North, because we realize that while our oppression may be different, our liberation is still connected to each other. And that's really important for us to acknowledge.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And we know how powerful language is. And even just like looking at the phrase climate change, and how a few years ago, that was what everyone was saying. And now that's we're moving away from that, because it doesn't convey the danger, immediate and urgency exactly.
Yeah, I do like the term MAPA better, because I feel like, you know, it's getting picked up a lot nowadays by a lot of people, even beyond the climate movement. And I think that's important, because MAPA, what I personally also like about it is, even though it started off with meaning to be just the Global South, I think we went beyond borders at one point. And to me personally, that was super important to, you know, see beyond borders, because borders can be so constraining, and a lot of people face similar oppression, and I don't think we should be divided by borders, honestly.
Quite right.
Absolutely. This has given me a lot to think about, actually, because working in journalism, we've moved away from, obviously, third world country was something that a term that used to be used. And then it moved to Global South, became kind of the adopted term and the term that was used most widely. But actually, this is giving me a lot to think about in terms of maybe we should be questioning that, because it's obviously very problematic as well. And terms like MAPA are maybe more appropriate and, yeah, explain the situation as it is.
Definitely.
Yeah. Just quickly, Disha, can you just explain, you are one of the co-founders of Fridays for Future India. Can you explain like how that happened? You know, did you go, did you see what was happening in the news and think we need to do this? And who was in that group?
So I think even before Fridays for Future started, I was involved with different citizen mobilizations around environment and animal rights in the city. And that's around the time, I mean, it was a year before, but around that time, the Fridays for Future movement took off, and it just made sense because young people needed a platform, and because we are going to be impacted more than the others but because of the climate crisis. And I think it was super random. I was like, okay, let's do this in the city. I quite literally posted a story on Instagram saying, hey, we need to do this here too. Does anyone want to organize with me? Because I didn't know too many young people that were doing similar things. And a mutual friend connected me to another person who had apparently posted a similar story. And she was also from the city. So it was lovely. And we essentially started at Fridays for Future Bangalore. And a few other people from Mumbai and Delhi had reached out, and other smaller cities that weren't the big cities. And this was right before the first global strike on 15th March in 2019. And it was 15 days before, I think on March 4th is when we actually had our first, meeting or call, I remember that day. Other people from across the country had reached out. It was a very random, we don't know each other, but we want to do the same thing, so let's do it. It was exciting, and it was also a leap of faith because you're just starting this with a bunch of people who are now a part of a community, and I trust them fully. But yeah, it was beautiful. And no one really calls themselves founders. I think it was in one paper and it got picked up by everybody else. I don't call myself that because I feel like it impresses upon people that I single-handedly did all of this. And it also puts a lot of pressure on me to always be perfect and to always be able to do absolutely everything that people expect of me. But the truth is that Fridays for Future India, or even Bangalore, wasn't just started by me. It was a group of people who consistently showed up every single day until, we were a huge community that that didn't rely on one person. And it's the same with Fridays for Future India. And I feel like the term founder really credits only one person and put that person on a pedestal. And I think that's something we need to rethink. So I don't really call myself that.
Sure. I think that's really important, actually. So it's a movement rather than it's all on one person's shoulders.
Yeah.
And going back to that moment that you decided to, or you got involved with Fridays for Future Bangalore, you were setting this up, you posted that message on your stories and other people responded, and you kind of realized there was other people out there who felt the same and wanted to act. Was there a moment that you can think of growing up, or maybe it was around that time, that you kind of moved from witnessing the climate crisis and the impacts of it to thinking, actually, I need to do something about this and I need to reach out to other people? Was there kind of something you saw or experienced that made that change for you?
I don't think it was a single moment for me, because it was a series of repeated things that made me question why this is happening or why this is the way it is. Why do people not have access to basic water? And these are quite literally basic human rights. And we shouldn't be begging for them, but it does feel like we are. I started reading about how all of these incidents are interlinked, and I found out that this is all because of the climate crisis and how it started. But even the version that Google presents to you is kind of whitewashed. And it took me a while of working with people on the ground in Bangalore and around India for me to understand that there's more, and that India actually has a very, very rich history of environmentalism and environmental protest. And it's a very, very political issue because, land grabbing has been happening since the beginning of time for people in India. And people who have to live based on their caste and religion in different areas that are more prone to the climate crisis, it's always been political for them. It's not just about hugging trees, although, hugging trees is important, but it is more than that. And I think that's when I realized that I'm very grateful for that shift in knowledge.
So you're tapping into this rich history of environmentalism that has kind of combined with these more modern movements, I guess, with Fridays for Future and Extinction Rebellion. There seems to be a really active scene in India, and especially with young activists as well. Can you tell us what happened after you, after Fridays for Future Bangalore was formed? What happened since then, and what kind of things have you been campaigning on? Obviously, it's been a wild few years. There's been so much going on.
So I think when we initially started, we were focused on community building because we were also not sure what to do. So we spent a lot of time engaging in like cleanup drives and tree plantation drives. And we had our usual Friday strikes. And we did build a really strong community, and we protested on local issues. A lot of the local issues in Bangalore are essentially unsustained development that leads to, you know, worsening the underground water levels or cutting off more trees, which essentially decreases the forest, not the forest, the green cover in Bangalore. And it causes, you know, it worsens the air pollution that already exists in the city. So these were the issues we took up locally. And we took some legal action on it with the larger environmental movement. And we realized that FFF or any single movement can't do it alone. So for us, it's very, very important to collaborate with other movements, both in the city, across, you know, the country and the world. We build on collaboration because we strongly believe that none of us can do it alone. And I appreciate that so much because the people who come together are phenomenal and so inspiring. And across India, I think we worked on a lot of policy level changes and amplifying what the local regions are doing, because India is ridiculously huge.
It is.
Yes. Where do you start?
Yeah. And it was such a task just to like reach out to all the local groups, because so many had formed over the years, so over the months, and just to get to know them, onboard them, you know, build a community with them and amplify their local issues, and as on a national level, work on policy issues that the government's passing and diluting environmental protection laws. So we did all of them while protesting on ground. It was almost too much because I feel like we burst out and just did things without stopping to breathe. So it's been definitely hectic for the past few years.
So obviously this podcast is about hope, Disha, and I think, you know, as Jesse and I live in the UK, and we see really hopeful stories about people such as yourself who are using their voices and platforms to make real change in the world. And I think we see that as something really hopeful. But, you know, as you sitting in your balcony in Bangalore right now, where do you see hope? And from your position in a MAPA country, where do you see the hope in the international community?
I think it was Audre Lorde who said that we have to practice hope every day, and that we have to reimagine futures that we want. And I take that very, very seriously, because the times we live in aren't easy. There's a pandemic, there's war, and there's just obviously the, you know, existing climate crisis that's looming over all of us. So it's a struggle, but also a very, very conscious effort for me to practice hope every single day. I always write down things that make me feel hopeful, like small things. Like yesterday morning, I saw this really little nice little sunbird dance outside my bedroom window, and it was beautiful. And the fact that, you know, birds are still there and it's summer and they were doing that little thing, it's beautiful. I like being on calls, and the people I'm on call with can hear parakeets that are like flying.
Oh, wow.
So I think I'm hopeful that there's some form of, you know, wildlife with where I live. But I also make a conscious effort to practice hope in different ways, with by engaging with the climate community and doing things that make me happy in general, because rest is a form of resistance and hope is a form of resistance, because the world doesn't really want you to be hopeful. I think the internet actively sets out to make sure that you're not hopeful. And I think one of the more interesting things I've done is not spend as much time on the internet anymore. I come on there to post message, talk about the climate crisis, and leave, because I have, like, I can read the news, I can read other things. I do spend some time on social media to read just enough to know what's happening, but not enough for it to, you know, mentally impact me in the wrong way. So yeah, it's an active effort to reimagine what we want, reimagine a world where, you know, people and the planet and its inhabitants are put over profit. And I do that, like, it's a very tough thing to do because life is so hard right now with everything. But I do go back to that saying that if you can't reimagine what you want the world to look like, you won't be able to achieve it because you aren't working towards it. So that's what I like to do.
Oh, wow. You speak so beautifully about hope, about everything. And that Audre Lorde quote, I just wrote that down because I think that's going to be my new mantra. You have to practice hope every day.
Absolutely. And I'm really interested that you said about how, you know, joy is and rest is a kind of form of resistance. And I think that's such an important idea, that kind of finding joy and leisure time, and especially as a woman, and women in society often do take on more or have less leisure time. So I can see how that would be, you know, an act of resistance to take that time back. And being in the climate activism, being in climate activism, you need to take that time to restore yourself. Could you talk a little bit about community and the community, especially of women that you've built around you? And why is that important in your work? Why is it important to embed female empowerment into climate activism?
I think it's, I honestly can talk about community endlessly because I love them all so much. But I've also noticed that the strongest friendships I have are the ones with women and non-binary people and people who are non-men around the world. And I don't know what the reason is, but they've always been there for me in ways that I can't even express. People I haven't met, people I've worked with on the internet, haven't, you know, had a second thought before they raised hell when I was arrested. They wouldn't stop speaking about it. And, you know, there were people who were at home with my mother taking care of her. And I think just the fact that a community came together to support me and my mother and things legally is something I didn't expect to see. But in general, also just the fact that there were friendships and relationships across the world that I have with people in the climate movement is absolutely beautiful, because it's a reminder of hope. It's a reminder of very, very radical love, because they all love, you know, so radically without thinking, without a second thought. It's like the literature book kind of love, where you don't really consider the consequences of something, but you do it because you strongly just believe that it's all going to work out. It's kind of like that. It feels irrational, but that's how you love your community, because you trust in them and you trust what they're doing is going to work out. But you also know that if it doesn't, you're there to hold them accountable. You're there to call them in when they make mistakes, while also understanding that, you know, we are bound to make mistakes because the power structures and the systems of oppression that exist outside also exist within us, because we were born into these systems. So it's the love that they hold when we make these mistakes, or, you know, uphold these system of oppressions, because they live in us. And that calling in, that rectifying, that holding us accountable is something that I find very powerful, because in an age of like cancel culture, where everyone just expects everyone to be perfect on the internet, I think with community, I realized that that's not the case.
Tisha, would you have any advice for someone who's listening who thinks, I want that, I want community, I want empowerment, might be a person of any gender listening to that and feeling that? What advice would you have to someone who wants to find a community but feels like they haven't found theirs yet?
I think it's completely fine if you haven't found your community yet, because sometimes it does take a while. But once you do, it's amazing. And also, you can build your own community. You can build in the kind of community and love you want, because there are a lot of people who just want community care. You know how we keep saying go to therapy and seek help. And they are super, super important things. But I feel like on some days, there are things community care and love that can do that you can't do with like self-care. So I think while we don't talk enough about community care, and that's super, super important in a world that is built on capitalism and individualism.
Yeah, and also, would you see? I've recently been the benefactor of a lot of community care, and people that I've known my whole life growing up, and people who live near my family home, and it was the most extraordinary outpouring of support and love. Just as what you were describing really resonated with me, and I think it was interesting that actually it was a kind of physical proximity, literally living on the same streets as these people and attending the same kind of buildings and institutions together. And obviously the online communities now have completely flourished and bloomed, and you can have that same connection, but people in across oceans and countries. But I do see that there's, something about being physically close to people and within walking distance. And, I think that's something that people should be prioritizing to find close to them if they can.
Yeah, I completely agree. My best friends from school live like 20 minutes away from me. And we see each other every day because we do some activity or the other every single day together, be it like reading or like just cycling together or working out or something. We do it every single day, or like 6 days a week or 5 days a week, because we recognize the importance of just being able to keep in touch that way, being able to build a community, just the three of us sometimes. To share space and to share worries and problems and our emotions. I think the space we hold for each other has really benefited me, especially because of the pandemic. I couldn't see other people, so the fact that people I grew up with and I can still see them really changed a lot of things for me, just gave me so much hope.
And coming back to the idea of this community, and obviously we've spoken about how women and non-binary people do seem to be leading this movement across the world. And I wonder whether that's because, in a way, that they are, groups, the most marginalized groups are most impacted by the climate crisis. And whether that's it's a bit of a double-edged thing. So obviously the burden is on marginalized groups, and they are also leading this climate movement. And I wanted to ask you about racism and environmentalism, and how, when you see events like COP26 and things like that that have been criticized for being really elitist and very white and definitely not representative of the people who are most affected, how does that differ within the climate movement itself? And I mean, I feel like I get a lot of hope from the climate movement and the people who are kind of upending that and taking action. But what's the comparison for you between events like COP26 and the work that you're doing on the ground?
I think personally that COP26 and just large environmental and climate conferences are such a scam, because they are basically PR events where the world leaders come and they always showcase, oh, we're doing that. And it's like, who has the better publicist to make the world believe that they're doing enough for the climate crisis? And I think my friend Aisha actually described it in a very funny way. She called it the Coachella of the climate. The climate movement. She said that no,
that's so true.
Just doing it for the gram.
Yeah, they do.
But with no Beyonce there, so
they do. They just come and do it for like a picture on the leading newspaper or something.
Coachella 26.
So Aisha actually described it as them coming in like fancy cars and
how many Teslas can you get in a car park?
Yeah, and everyone flying in for it.
Yeah, they come in like fleets of cars, booking out all the hotels, and they fly.
Yeah, they've kind of missed the point.
And they make it so inaccessible for other people to come. And obviously, I couldn't make it because I never got a passport. from like the authorities. I got it much after COP was over. It was like a lot of red tape that I had to cross that wasn't necessary for me to cross. It was a violation of like my civil liberties and rights in India. But apart from that, it's the fact that, you know, we sent indigenous people. There were three people from FF India, and two of them were indigenous people. And the other one was the woman who went from India to COP26. And it was so hard for them. It was so hard for us to get visas. We had to apply for the last minute visa that comes through really fast. And even that took a while for them to face racism and colorism in COP, where they were constantly ignored just because some of them didn't speak the language. They didn't speak English, or they spoke it, but they spoke it in a different way than what people spoke there. They were constantly ignored. They told me they were traumatized from COP and they never want to go back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go to any international event ever again because they felt tokenized. And sometimes, like, no one ever really listened to what they had to say, but sometimes they were just called because representation matters. So just the fact that the visa process is so long, it's so ridiculously expensive to get there. And like, none of us obviously had the money to get there. And it was a lot of support from other people who offered to take them as a part of, you know, their NGOs, like delegation, and very grateful for that. But getting there also didn't help because they were barely able to get their voices heard. They were deliberately silenced. It was really, really taxing for them mentally, emotionally. So obviously I don't like COP because it's also a way for them to act like they only have power during COP or in that one particular month that COP happens, when in reality, world leaders have had the power throughout the year since they came into office to make a difference, to act on the climate crisis. But they only talk about acting on the climate crisis in COP, and they go back home and they still, you know, drill the ocean floors, still, you know, mine a richness out of like forests and hills, and still cut down trees, and still, you know, destroy any water body there is. So I don't think what they're saying is really meaningful because it's so far away from the truth, and it's just honestly pretty words that's dressed up, but you know, we can smell the stink.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just so frustrating. Mm-hmm. I can feel the frustration through the screen, Nisha, from you, mm-hmm. about exactly as you said, like the effort to get there is so great. Mm-hmm. And then once they're there, it's just like completely unsatisfying. It's really frustrating, mm-hmm. not being listened to, the lack mm-hmm. of respect. It's awful. And I'm so sorry that happened.
Or sometimes you do get called on panel to present a youth perspective. And I've often realized that I've been on a panel recently with two men. I was the only woman. They were considered highly qualified to comment on the issues. And I was always asked very like patronizing questions almost about the youth movement, and very like soft questions about what to do or how to inspire youth to bring together. But all the questions about what's happening in terms of science and with the people were asked to the more quote-unquote qualified men. And I realized they used my picture in the when it came out in the media, but they hadn't used anything I said in the actual print. So it's often presented as, oh, we have a woman, she's young, so she can present a youth perspective, but we're not going to listen to her. And that's often the case because they tokenize your experiences and what you have to say, and they don't think it's relevant because you don't have big degrees or you're not a man.
That's so frustrating. And it seems like on a wider level, white activists as well are prioritized over people of color, and that they are platformed more. I mean, I wanted to ask you about the Greta Thunberg comparison, because I mean, Greta's spoken about this as well, about how activists around the world are kind of the Greta Thunberg of Bangalore. Or there was that famous photograph where Vanessa Nakate was edited out because they assumed she wasn't a climate activist. And
So as well as, you know, sexism and being there as a token woman, as a token young person, what's your experience as a person of color and how that plays into kind of being tokenized in, you know, on panels or in the climate movement or by leaders?
I think it's hilarious that they call me Greta of Bangalore, because Greta is a good friend. She's amazing. She does amazing work. She's a lovely person. I don't think she's the one typing any of this. So I know she feels the same.
Oh, yeah.
And she's spoken about it vocally in the past, too. It's the fact that, why is it so hard for you to learn our names? Why is it, by every time they compare me to Greta, or every time they compare me to a white person, calling me, you know, the quote-unquote Greta of Bengaluru, or any person of Bengaluru, they erase my stories and my struggles and really just, you know, put me in the category as Greta. And while she's done amazing work, our stories are very, very different. Our situations are very, very different. Just the environment in which we have to organize is so different. We don't have strikes every Friday anymore in Bangalore because it's literally not possible for us to have it. It's dangerous for us to protest every Friday in so many ways, and we can't do that anymore. So when they refuse to learn our names and they compare us to, you know, white figures, it's often just racism in a very, very different form, because how hard is it to learn about what I do, or, you know, write about what I do? I don't really particularly care about being in the media or being the face of anything. But if you are going to write about it, don't push me under the bus and refuse to do the basic research. And then compare me to a white person just because it'll get you more clicks on your article. So I personally think it's very frustrating for me. I don't particularly care about some of these because it's just so frustrating, honestly. And it's not the first time we've spoken about it, but they refuse to listen. So I like to focus my energy on things that I actually... not with these people. So moving on from them, I don't work with people who refuse to learn my name or refuse to learn people of color's name, because situations, stories are erased when you do that. And
quite right.
Yeah.
We are coming near to the end of our time together, Disha. I feel like we could talk to you for hours more. I just wanted to ask you about... I suppose, you know, if someone's listening right now and they feel like they really want to go and do something, and I had a little look on the Fridays for Future India website today, and right at the top it says like save the world with a few clicks or something, and I thought that was an interesting way.
You're doing our website. Don't look at it right now. Like, it's in an editorial state, so it's like all our old pages are up.
I liked it and I was grabbed, and I think, you know, people, you know, everyone is busy, everyone's got things they need to do, but the world is literally burning and we need to do something about it. So, you know, if you had one thing that you could say to our listeners right now to say go and do this thing, mm-hmm. is it a petition, is it fundraising, what is it, what would be one thing they could go and do today?
I think it's important for people to realize that sustainability or anything they practice can look very, very different from another person. So there's not one way that they can take action. And everyone can be a part of the movement in some way or the other. Like you said, Jesse, you're a journalist and you have a role to play by writing about the climate crisis. Me as a writer, I have a role to play by writing about it in other ways. And there are musicians and artists who can talk about the climate crisis in their own way. And I feel like we're fed this narrative that we have to be zero waste, or we have to like not fly and all of these things to be considered perfect environmental activists. But there's no such thing. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. Not all of us have the resources or the knowledge or access to the knowledge to adhere to what is, you know, prescribed as the perfect environmental activist. And sustainability is really, really, really different for every one of us. So I think contributing in a way that you know the best is perfect, because if say you have say you just work in an office and you have a corporate job, it can be as simple as changing company policy to reduce waste in your own building, and you know, changing packaging of your company, or you know, smaller things on how waste is treated, water is treated, and it can be small things, or it can be engaging in public policy level, or organizing on ground, or writing about it, creating content on social media, you know, using art to convey the message, because art really crosses all language barriers and communicates something that words sometimes can fail to. And I love words, but still.
We'd like to ask you a few questions to finish up today about, we call it Hope in a Hurry, very snazzy title. Tilly, do you want to go through these, Tilly?
Sure. So when you're looking for a bit of hope, what is your hopeful read? So a book, magazine, paper, blog?
Oh my God, that's a tough question. I don't have one particular book, but I like fiction and literature because sometimes I just like to go away from... They travel to words, and I find hope from the different solutions it has. And also fiction has the power of reimagining worlds and the future and people that nonfiction can never do. It has a way with words and imagination that nonfiction fails to do, and that's what I want to do. My thing is reading fiction. Sometimes my favorite author though is Enid Blyton, and I have a lot of others, but she's
Enid Blyton. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, I grew up
so English.
Yes, she is English, but I read her when I was a child, and it's what got started me on reading. Because we had a local library that just housed all her books, and I spent so much time reading all her books. And sometimes I just go back to some of the comfort it offers.
Love that.
A bit of escapism.
So what is your hopeful watch? So this could be a film or a TV show or documentary.
I watch anime.
Yes.
I watch a lot of anime. I don't think I really have favorites when it comes to anything, because I like too many things. So I'm currently watching this show called Attack on Titan, and it's also about like worlds colliding, so that's interesting. But I like reimagine anything that really reimagine the world we live in, because it makes me question a lot of the systems we live in, a lot of practices we do. So I think that's why I read fiction and watch anime, because it does that in a very subtle and nice way.
I totally relate to that, because I read a lot of fantasy, and I think it's exactly that. It's escapism as well as inspiration. Okay, so what is your hopeful listen? So maybe a podcast that you like to listen to that puts you in a good mood.
I actually have this one podcast that I really like. Let me just see the name. It just reads poetry to you, and
I love that.
Yeah, I like listening to literary fiction a lot, but let me find this channel. What's it called? I love listening to Hot Take. It's by Amy and this other person called Mary Hegler. I hope I'm pronouncing their name right, but I love that podcast. I think that's the one podcast that gives me a lot of hope. And I also like to listen to this channel on Spotify. I don't know if that's called a channel, but they're called Poetry Unbound. They just read poetry to you out loud. They have a lot of poetry that connects to the earth. I love both of them.
Beautiful. And finally, do you have any, one hopeful anthem, like a song that really puts you in the mood, and that we can play at the end of the podcast as we play out?
The song that really gives me hope is called Ghar, which means home in Hindi. It's by this artist called Bharat Chauhan. It talks about, you know, your connection with home, and it really reminds me of my connection with the earth, and it's really beautiful. So I love that song.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. So here's this is Dish's prescription for hope. It's Hope in a Hurry. We'll put all of those recommendations in the show notes so you can get on those immediately. So finally, thank you so much for joining us, Disha. It's been so good to talk to you. Can you tell our listeners how they can follow you, how they can keep up with your work?
Yes. Thank you for having me. It was so lovely talking to you. I think this is one of the nicest podcast recordings I've done. This is so much fun.
Oh, we've loved it.
Yeah, it's been really fun.
We'll have you back anytime.
Thank you so much. They can follow me on @DishaRavi with two I's in the end on Twitter and Instagram, which I use.
@DishaRavi and with two I's. And I just want to say your Instagram is amazing and you're so clearly a talented writer, because the Instagram post that you posted about the IPCC really took my breath away in your descriptions of the things you want to do. So go away now, get your phone out, go to Disha's Instagram and follow her and find that post, because it was so beautiful. Fantastic. And we just want to say thank you so much one more time, and good luck with everything that you're doing, and keep in touch with us, okay?
Yeah, thank you so much, Disha. It's been so lovely to chat.
Thank you so much. This was so nice. तुम्हारे जाने के बाद कोई आया नहीं.
What a conversation. Disha Ravi is an absolute A-lister. I'm so happy we had her on the podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to speak to her, and she had so many cool things to say. I'm just so thrilled we got to chat to her.
Yeah, totally. I feel so inspired after that conversation. It's made me feel just so empowered to do things, and she had so many great ideas, and just also she's a lot of fun and so joyous.
She had the best laugh ever. I love that quote that she said about having to practice hope every day. And I think I'm going to take that forward into this week, because it's like seeing hope as an action or as a verb, and something we can get better at as well.
Yeah, definitely. Really cool. Like an exercise. It's a muscle that we can flex and build up. And
yeah,
I mean, thank goodness we've got people like her, and in the face of such huge challenges, that she is actually doing so much good work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see what her hope in a hurry was in the show notes, and I loved her recommendations for those were so good. And don't forget, you can also follow her at Disha Ravi with two I's. So that's, I think that's the end of today's podcast. So thank you so much for joining us. Please do follow us at WeDoHope_podcast. And our website is www.wedohope.org.com.
Definitely. And thank you so much for joining us today. And do let us know if you do check out any of Disha's recommendations for hope in a hurry. Let us know what you thought. And yeah, keep listening. And please do recommend us to a mate if you've enjoyed it today. And thank you so much. And see you next time.
Bye. This podcast is brought to you by Amos Trust, a small creative human rights organisation based in the UK. Amos aims to challenge injustice, restore rights and create hope, working with grassroots partners in three main areas: street justice, Palestine justice and climate justice. They work in creative, responsive and collaborative ways to bring about local solutions to global issues. For more details, please visit amostrust.org.uk.